The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order, and we're continuing to take testimony on the governor's budget recommendations. And the first person on the agenda today is Deborah Schlick, to be followed by James Carlson.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Deborah Schlick with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of nonprofits from around the state of Minnesota. I am here to speak about the cuts the governor proposes to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. I will just quickly echo concerns you heard yesterday about the intent to cut MFIP grants to families with disabled parents and children, and want to make a couple of points about that. The vast majority of families affected by those cuts will be families in which the parent is disabled and has been determined by the federal government as unemployable. So these are families in which there is no option to go into the workplace and replace those cuts with earnings. We would argue that the good news the federal government sent, that there's an unexpected $28 million in federal TANF stimulus funds, ought to stay in this committee and could offset cuts like that. We are also concerned about the cuts the governor proposes to the supported work program in the MFIP program. The I believe it's $1.2 million the governor proposes to cut out of that. Looking at some numbers that we've seen from the state, in one quarter in 2009, the state spent about $1 million in supported work, which was roughly 150,000 hours of work. With some back-of-the-envelope calculations, looks like the equivalent of 305 FTEs. We think that sort of level of cuts in jobs is the wrong movement at the wrong time.
Thank you. The federal funds that you're talking about, could you just talk a little more about that?
When the administration presented the budget, they explained that in addition to the federal stimulus funds they expected, they had learned that because of payments we make through the Working Family Credit, there's an additional $28 million available. The governor would take that $28 million and refinance it through the Working Family Credit for $28 million in general fund cuts. We think since we've seen more than $400 million of TANF money go to the general fund, that TANF money ought to stay in this committee and ought to be used to prevent cuts to families who are using the cash assistance program.
But there isn't any new federal funding that you know about.
No. We do know that the same members of Congress who are trying to extend FMAP are also trying to keep an extension of the emergency TANF funds that came under the stimulus bill in play beyond this fiscal year.
And do you know about how much that would be if we received it?
Madam Chair, I do not. My assumption is that it would be close to the numbers we've seen currently under the stimulus funds, because it would, for the most part, continue the emergency TANF funds as they appeared under the stimulus. We would earn money for our non-recurrent short-term assistance funds under DWP and emergency assistance. We would earn money on our supported work expenses, and we'd earn money for any caseload increase.
So can you just remind me how much we've gotten? Do you remember?
I believe, Madam Chair, that so far we've gotten in the neighborhood of $44 million. I do know that DHS put together an update in January. They got the news about the additional $28 million after the update they presented in January. And I honestly can't remember the final total.
So it might be 44 plus the 28.
It may be, but it would be better to ask the department.
Yes, we'll do that. Okay. Any other questions?
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, if I can add one piece. Should
sure.
Congress extend those TANF emergency funds, the cut to families with disabled parents and children would mean we would not draw down one of those channels of TANF funds, because we're rewarded for the maintaining or increasing the assistance we're paying out.
Right, and so maybe we can figure out how much that would be that is at risk. Any other questions? Thank you very much. James Carlson, to be followed by Bishop Rognes.
Good morning, Madam Chair. And thank you for the opportunity to testify before the Health Human Services Budget Division on the subject of the governor's cuts. My name is James Carlson. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Child Care Works, a statewide coalition of child care advocates working to develop public policy initiatives that increases the affordability, accessibility, and quality of child care. We understand the budget woes continue and that the critical decisions will be made, not only for child care, but for many other very important areas of human services. We appreciate and understand the difficulty of the task ahead, and we would like to offer our assistance to you. I'm here to describe the ways to propose cuts to child care, particularly the 5% provider rate reductions, will substantially erode the integrity of the child care assistance program. It will harm businesses, small businesses, will lead to job losses, and will disrupt thousands of Minnesotans, families with young children, and small business owners around the state. A 2003 study of the economic impact of child care industry in Minnesota reported three key facts. It has a current and immediate impact on the economy by supporting working parents to stay employed. It has a long-term impact on the economy by providing quality programs that prepare children for school, reducing costs for a range of social services. And child care, is a major contributor to the economy. It's composed of over 11,000 small business owners, providing jobs for over 36,000 Minnesotans and generating approximately $1 billion per year for the state economy. They provide care for 360,000 children in Minnesota. Our child care system is required by federal legislation to give families using child care assistance equal access to different types of care. As of 2009, 32% of child care centers and 40% of family care givers, providers, are technically within the reach of the child care assistance families, unless the families or the program can pay for the districts themselves. As a result of the 2003 cuts, we have seen a net loss of nearly 2,000 licensed care providers around the state, resulting in thousands of jobs, losses, and disruption to thousands of families. Every closing has multiple impacts. The loss of a small business, jobs, continuity of provider training, and loss of stability to families, and interruption of the close relationships that have been built with children and critical adults in their lives. If the governor's recommendation to cut 5% rate passes, providers will be forced to choose between passing on the additional cost to their parents or accepting a decreased rate, threatening the financial health of their small businesses. Passing on the cost to parents makes child care out of reach for many parents, especially low income, who the cost of care is disproportionately high in compared to high income parents. The lowest income families count on child care assistance to make work and child care a possibility. These increases will force them to choose between staying in the workforce or settling for care that may be less safe or inconsistent, or leaving the workforce to care for the children themselves. Based on previous experience in 2003, many families will choose the latter and rejoin MFIP and other government programs. In addition, many providers who primarily care for children from low-income to moderate-income families will choose simply to close their doors and lay off their employees. Many other providers will no longer offer the care to CCAP children because they will not have access to the resources necessary to cover the actual cost of care. I want to conclude by reiterating our concern that cost of child care assistance program, particularly the proposed reduction in rates, will erode the integrity of CCAP program, will lead to small businesses closures, will reduce the ability to parents with young children to find work, and will cause disruptions to thousands of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Thank you.
And thank you for being willing to come back today.
No problem.
Bishop Rognes and Mark Peterson, you want to come up together?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I'm Peter Rognes. I serve as Bishop of the St. Paul Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I have three things to say. First, I want to speak as a pastor. I know these are among the hardest days state legislators have ever faced in Minnesota. You face painful economic times. You face very hard choices. Lots of people get to tell you what we think, and then you have to make the decisions when we walk away. So whether I disagree or agree with what you do, I pray that each of you has strength and wisdom and the ability to get up and face these choices on behalf of all of us. There are thousands of people around the state who pray for you and thank you for what you do. I want you to hear that. That's number one. Number two, I speak not as a provider of specific services so much as one who wants to speak to the framing of the entire budget discussion and the assumptions behind the proposal. These deliberations aren't so much a numbers game to balance a budget. This is a morality play unfolding. You may think that's melodramatic. I don't mean by that all you have to do is choose good versus evil. I know it's not that easy. What I do mean is that the choices we make when we frame a budget, when we decide what it'll do and not do, those choices involve moral judgments. These decisions affect people's lives, and that makes our budget a moral document. There's a remarkable convergence among all the faith traditions of the people of this state. A wide variety of faith traditions all converge around the simple truth that the measure of our faithfulness to our deepest values as a people, the measure of that faithfulness is shown in how we treat those that are most vulnerable among us, the poor, the sick, the aged, the disabled, the children. It's a moral choice that we make in deciding we will care for the vulnerable or we don't. We help sick people get well or we don't. We provide care and education for our children. We create a healthy community for us all. Those are all moral values we exercise. So that brings me to point three. So you're thinking, here's a do-gooder in a collar saying we all ought to plead for money to spend money on worthy causes, and we just don't have the money. I know that. I know about the economic realities. But I also think that we, the people of the state, we aren't even being asked if we're willing to help shoulder the burden so that the most vulnerable among us don't lose things that are essential. Churches are doing what we can, stellar work, I think, but not nearly what we can do together as a whole people across the whole state. Let's put on the table the question of finding ways to keep safety nets and infrastructures from being torn apart. I don't know if it's returning to the income tax rates of the 90s instead of the 2000s, or excluding fewer items from the sales tax, or looking again at gas tax or alcohol tax or carbon tax or tobacco. Call it tax or call it fees or call it licenses. It doesn't matter what we call it. These are all simply ways we have as a people together in this state to decide how we're going to live together and how we're going to care for each other and then how we're going to fund what we decide to do. So those are my three things. First, I thank you for your service. Second, please view the budget and the choices therein as a moral document reflecting the values that we as a people have to care for people who most need our care. And third, step aside from the arbitrary ceilings on revenue and find ways to invite us as the people of this state to live out the values that we have together. I thank you for this time, and I especially thank you for the hard work that you do. Thank you.
Mark Peterson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to echo the Bishop in thanking you for the hard work and the hard task that you face. I'm here today on behalf of the 100,000 persons LSS of Minnesota is privileged to serve each year. I'm here today specifically to speak on behalf of the more than 1,200 persons with developmental disabilities that we serve in many different ways, in many different kinds of settings around the state. I'm here especially to speak about Ethel. Ethel was one of those persons who as a child was placed in one of the state hospitals where we all warehoused her and thousands like her. And then later, thanks to the courts, Ethel had the opportunity to live in community. In this case, Ethel was able to move into an LSS home some 20 years ago in the Fergus Falls community with three other ladies where she's lived for the past 20 years. Ethel dearly loves Beth, who is an LSS employee who's worked with Ethel for nearly all of that time that Ethel's been in that home. Beth used to visit Ethel on her days off, but in the last several months, Beth has not been able to do that because she's needed to take a second job to support her family. Beth still takes Ethel shopping once a week. Now that shopping trip once a week is to the local food shelf, and Ethel purchases food at the food shelf to help stretch the group home budget. One of Ethel's greater joys in life has been to watch a cable TV show about horses. In the past year, we have had to end our cable television service in our group home because of the budget cuts. We had to take away one of Ethel's greater joys. You may not think it's much, but for Ethel, it was a big deal. We're at the bare bones now. In the past 7 years since 2003, the cumulative rate increases that we've received have amounted to about 5%. And if the governor's budget is adopted, our cumulative rate increase since 2003 will be less than 2.5%. You can do that math. So how much more can we take away from Ethel? Now, LSS is exploring alternative settings that work and cost less. We want to be your partner in devising those and developing these new patterns of care. And it will be especially important, of course, in next year's budget cycle. But Ethel isn't going anywhere else soon. The people of Minnesota made a commitment to her when she moved from the state hospital into the community. I believe it's our duty to assure that she can live the rest of her days with a quality of life. On behalf of all that we serve, I thank you for your hard deliberation. I want to share with you a note from one of our residents here in Ramsey County who wrote, this woman wrote a letter to Senator Klobuchar that I think is appropriate for you as well. She writes, "Dear Amy, thank you for your hard work. I live with three other ladies, and we look out for each other. Please look out for each other. Please look out for us." From Kristen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll provide you copies of Kristen's letter.
Sure. Bishop Ragnes, it isn't exactly like we haven't tried to do revenue. And maybe there's a greater role churches could play in helping us to get there. I don't know. But so far, we haven't been able to be successful. So,
thank you. I know that. We are the Lutheran bishops of the state are seeking to launch conversations in our congregations, putting these kind of choices between our people so they understand the connection between revenue streams and services. I don't think it's a matter of just a few score of legislators. I think it's a matter of the political climate and the political will in the state. So I speak this morning not simply to a handful of legislators, but to the people of the state who I believe need to say we need to do this.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Burkett and Rick Stein, to be followed by Dr. Meaches.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Tim Burkett, CEO of People Incorporated, and I'm I know that you're facing the most difficult situation that you've faced in my career, and I assume most of your careers this year. I'm here to advocate for continued funding of our safe haven programs, People Incorporated safe haven programs for folks with mental illness. They've been in the base now since 2007, and the governor is recommending eliminating the $460,000 funding, which would close them down. When I came to work at People Incorporated about 14 years ago, I visited a drop-in center of ours in Minneapolis, and I noticed at the drop-in center at the community support program two lines of people inside, and I didn't know if they were waiting to go bowling because I knew there was some bowling going on, or if they were waiting for work on vocational assessments because I knew that was going on. I found out that one of the lines of people was waiting to use the washing machine, and the other line of people was waiting to use the shower. And I said to the program director there, a woman named Joan White, "What is going on here?" And she said, "Well, Tim, didn't you realize these people live outside?" And although I had been a psychologist and a human service professional for my whole life, I didn't know that. I didn't know that people with bipolar disorders, schizophrenia, anxiety disorder, serious and persistent depression were the folks who were living outside. And so we began working on that, as many people in the Twin Cities did, and began identifying them and began figuring out how to reach out to them, how to minister them, how to bring them inside. Finally, in 2005, after going out to the camps year after year after year, we developed a program in collaboration with the University of Minnesota Department of Psychiatry. And in your packet, you'll see a letter from Dr. John Vucetic, who is our lead psychiatrist, to move folks inside to two safe havens, two houses, one in St. Paul and one in Minneapolis, and give them 24/7 care and support, and then move them on to independence. So those houses have flourished since then. They save the taxpayers millions of dollars, because in an average of 120 days, we move people from living outside to being on their own. And you can look at the statistics on the sheet that I put in front of you. The average cost of a homeless person is $40,500 per year. It costs about $7,000 to put that person through our program. And after that, they make it on their own. Now, I won't say literally they make it on their own, because we follow, we continue to work with them, but that's of no additional cost for the rest of their lives as necessary. But they do surprisingly well, and we've been so successful that about 95% of the folks, of the more than 150 folks we've placed in the last 30 months, are still in independent living, or still in semi-independent living. So I know you're faced with lots of cuts, but if these folks, if this program has to close, it's the linchpin of our services to hundreds of homeless people. And if we can't bring them inside anymore, just going out to the camps is not good enough. So thank you for listening to me, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Yes, and Mr. Stein, did you want to testify also?
This is Rick Stein. Rick Stein is a graduate of our program, and he lived outside not too far from here for some time.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and
welcome to the committee.
My name is Rick Stein. I was homeless for a number of years. I suffer from severe depression. I first got connected with People Inc. through a lunch program through the Salvation Army. And with ongoing contact, I finally got into the program. It took a little while to build up a rapport, you know, the trust issue there. Once I got in, discovered that I had high blood pressure. Well, that sent off a whole chain of things because I'm still being diagnosed. been diagnosed with stage 2 hypertension, coronary artery disease. I've got a slipped disc, and my liver, the liver is a little bad, and my kidney. And there's a few other medical conditions I've got. With the help of this program, though, it's really helped me a lot. I stayed in a little bit longer than the average stay of 120 days. I stayed there for a few more months, longer than that, to help me get diagnosed with all this stuff. Take about 23 medications a day now. I'm planning on attending college this summer. What I really like about the Safe Haven program, though, is that they nudge people very gently once they're inside. And they work with all types of individuals that's got all different types of MI issues. That's mental illness and drug abuse, alcoholism. Help them get them back on their feet, get them stabilized, and then they get them into their own apartment. I've been in my own apartment now going on 3 years, and it's a great program. I also do volunteer work for them now. They have another program. It's called Project Recovery. That's not on the list, though, but I go out to the camps and that, and I take photos of some of the camps. And we dispense like toothpaste and mouthwash and stuff like that, basic needs. But getting back to Safe Haven, if this program's eliminated, there's a lot of people that are just going to slip under, you know, they're just going to slide away. Every year you hear about someone that's dying outside that's homeless. And people incorporated, they try and prevent that, you know. And we go to a lot of camps, even during snowstorms, we go out. It's a great program. I can't stress it enough. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you, Mr. Stein, for being willing to come and share your story with us. I know that's not easy. You might have never even been inside the Capitol before, so. Thank you for your courage to do that. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions? If not, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Meeches, to be followed by Joe Fukuko and Ann Parkins.
Good morning, Senator Berglund, members of the committee. I'm Bob Meeches. I'm Chief Executive of the Minnesota Medical Association, and I'm here on behalf of the MMA, representing approximately 11,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout the state. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. To the physicians of Minnesota, the governor's budget proposal is a disappointment. The budget lacks the leadership and vision to fundamentally solve the problems facing our safety net that thousands depend upon. Talk is easy, but leadership involves real and meaningful change. The Medical Association is here today to join the chorus of voices expressing concern and opposition to the governor's proposals. As the MMA has previously stated, our position is that the state's budget problems must be confronted directly with a more balanced approach. Yes, spending cuts, but also we need to raise revenues. We recognize the political challenge inherent in our position and that has already been addressed today, but we nevertheless remain steadfast in our position. The state must adequately finance its public health programs and support the least able among us. Specifically, the MMA strongly opposes the eligibility cuts for Minnesota care adults. The proposal on the table represents a giant step backward. Nearly 16 years backwards. In fact, That's how long MinnesotaCare has been providing care coverage for low-income working adults. Minnesota's historic position of having the lowest rate of uninsured has already been lost, and this proposal will result in a more significant drop, harming the health of thousands of individuals. Additionally, the proposed medical education and research, or MERC, cuts reduce the state's longstanding commitment to support certain medical education and research programs in a more equitable manner than through patient care services. Although the Medical Association acknowledges that the bulk of these MERC funds come from the Medicaid program, we are opposed to the siphoning off of MERC-dedicated cigarette tax proceeds in order to help balance the general fund, $1 million this year and $1.5 million annually thereafter. The Medical Association has also long argued that in order to bend the so-called cost curve to decrease the rate of increase and begin to decrease that, it will require a comprehensive strategy, including investments in public health and prevention. We are very disappointed that the governor is proposing to reduce by more than 20% the statewide health improvement program financing allocated in 2008. That's $10 million out of a total of $47 million appropriation. The governor's 3% MinnesotaCare managed care withhold proposal is certain to result in reductions in payment rates for services provided to MinnesotaCare enrollees. The MMA continues to believe that greater transparency is needed in how Minnesota managed care plans are managing the dollars entrusted to them by the state. We believe provisions adopted last year in the legislature are a good first step, but this proposal is an important reminder that cuts to physicians and other providers may be indirectly adopted as a result to reductions in managed care rates. We join, in addition, in expressing the frustration with using professional license fees to balance the state budget, which is the effect of the governor's proposal to reduce by 3% the operating budget of the Board of Medical Practice. And finally, the governor proposes ratification of his unallotment decision to reduce by 1.5% the public program rates paid for non-primary care services. With this rate cut, the department indicates that payments for non-primary care services will be above the national average. Well, the national average Medicaid rate, however, is about 70% of the Medicare rate, and we all know the challenges with Medicare rates in Minnesota. It's really abysmal. But the governor's proposal in this area reflects a symptom of a bigger problem, an out-of-date and flawed public program fee schedule. The Medical Association must again express its frustration with the Minnesota Department of Human Services for failing to implement a resource-based relative value for the fee schedule as you directed it to do in 2003. You gave the department 3 years to complete this conversion, and now 7-8 years later, it has not been done. We ask you to hold them accountable for the legislation passed in 2003. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. Appreciate the opportunity to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Meeches. We've been doing a little bit of a big picture analysis of the governor's budget, and we believe it's nearly $200 million that he's using out of the Health Care Access Fund to balance the budget. And I know in the past you've had concerns about that. I didn't know if you were aware of the magnitude of the, I mean, it's more than half of the $347 million.
It's an extraordinary problem, and our concerns and our opposition to using that is on record with the governor, with his staff, and with all of you. We understand that the Healthcare Access Fund is going to go belly up very soon. And so we have to take care of this population. It is our, as pointed out early, our moral obligation. As a physician, I am trained as a professional to say, how do I help people? How do we help people? That's our job. And to simply make cuts without a balanced approach is untenable in our society today. And the governor needs to step up, and we would ask all of you to step up and provide the leadership to look for those solutions in a difficult time.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Joe and Ann, do you want to come up? And they'll be followed by Dick Derricks.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. senators, thank you for allowing this time for me to come up and share our concerns. I'm here with Ann Parkins, a resident from one of the facilities I'm representing. My name is Joe Cuoco. I am representative of the Association of Supportive Living Residences, which is a group of board and lodge facilities throughout the Twin Cities area, funded primarily through group residential housing funds, as well as waivered services. We wish to express our deep concerns over the proposed permanent 5% cut to our service rates in the GRH settings. This would affect about 4,300 people on a monthly basis. We already received a cut during the regular session last year. Then the governor came around and through his unallotment slashed us again by 5%, which is pretty devastating to us. We were able to get through the first rounds of cuts through, controlling our overtime, reducing the program activities for our residents, and unfortunately we also had to do some layoffs. But to allow the 5% would really be devastating to our services. Moreover, if the governor eliminates the $203 GA grants and eliminates the EGA, the emergency assistance, as well as the supplemental aid, emergency supplemental aid, where do those people go? Will they come to our facilities? And right now we really feel that with allowing this 5% to happen would really hurt our industry. We've already done layoffs. We feel like our staff-client ratio is we don't feel comfortable where it's at right now. We don't feel we have enough staff because of the layoffs we've had to do. And to deal with another 5%, we don't know where we would go to reduce, to offset those costs. And so we're asking to not allow the 5% to cuts that the governor is asking to make permanent from his unallotments to happen. Another thing is that our requirements have stayed the same, but funding has been reduced. And this is not the first time last year was not the first time either that our budgets have been cut. But for instance, a few years ago, we were required to provide nursing services for our facilities, and we were given money to do so. But we feel as if the rug has been pulled out from underneath us because we've upheld our end of the bargain, and then the governor comes and decides to slash us. So we still are required to do the nursing services and all the other services, but then the funding is not there. And so our question is, how are we supposed to remain with any type of profit and, help the people, help the residents, the 4,300 people? How are we supposed to do this if we are continually being cut in order to help the budget? So we are asking that this not happen. We strongly believe that this action will cost the state more in the end than this believed savings. It's kind of what Dr. Burkett originally, was talking about, the homelessness, the people standing in line. Well, we're one of the middlemen. We're one of the middle people that helps people from becoming homeless. And without us, the homelessness will swell. So, again, we just ask that you keep in mind that and, again, not to allow that permanent 5% unallotment to happen. And at this time, I will allow Ann Parkins. Again, she's one of the residents from our facilities to speak.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, ma'am, chairman, for inviting me here today to give my personal testimony on why I believe GRH funding should not be permanently cut off. Hello, my name is Ann Parkins. I am a resident at Ascension Place, a transitional housing facility funded through GRH. I am here today to tell you why I believe GRH funding should not be cut off and what I believe will happen if GRH funding is permanently cut. I grew up in a foster home. As a young adult, I suffered from depression and anxiety that was not recognized. It was unrecognized. It was hard to manage anxiety. It was hard to manage depression. I had suicidal thoughts. I'm was not on medication and had no support with my mental health. As an adult, I soon found myself homeless and was referred to a sheltering place by People Serving People, which is a homeless shelter I stayed at. At Ascension Place, I have my own case manager. My case manager supports me when I am having a bad day or when I get worried, and is helping me get on SSI. I have a mental health support group once a week. I go to volunteer at Open Arms. I have sewing classes, cooking classes, art classes, writing groups. All these services help me have a stable mental health. I am worried if GRH stays cut, I will get fewer classes to Ascension Place. I am worried that support groups and case management will be cut. Without these services, I will be deeply depressed. My feelings of hopelessness and suicidal thoughts would increase. I'm worried that these cuts will make Ascension Place more like a shelter rather than a supporting place to live, just a place where I eat and sleep. I worry that if GRH is cut, I may end up on the streets because of a lack of services. I have to keep my housing and move forward on my goals. I know myself well enough to know if I end up on the streets, I will not survive because I do not have the skills to. Thank you for listening to me today. Please support me by voting against permanent GRH budget cuts.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for the courage to come and talk to us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Joe, I'm wondering if you could think about something. I've been thinking about the idea that some of the people that live in group residential housing would be eligible for waivers. And I've been thinking about if we could convert some of the GRH slots to waiver slots, we could draw down some federal money to help support the programs, and then we could probably take some budget savings without hurting your programs.
Madam Chairman, it would help us, but I believe that the laws state that we cannot allow the waiver into our facilities unless there is some type of change with, I think, DHS.
Well, we would have to change the law. Obviously, we'd have to add more waiver slots to accommodate. But
that would definitely help offset the cost, yes.
Are there other questions? Thank you all, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.
Dick Derricks, to be followed by Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Belzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dick Derricks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. I have two concerns with the governor's supplemental budget that I would like to highlight for you today. First, the governor recommends modifying the critical access dental provider program eligibility criteria, and by so doing, reducing $3 million in expenditures for this program from the Health Care Access Fund. This modification to the criteria restricts critical access dental payments to only nonprofit clinics. This is a highly objectionable approach and would set dental access back severely, especially in greater Minnesota. The Minnesota Dental Association worked with Senator Berglund and the legislature in 2001 to create this program, which provides increased reimbursements to both private practice and nonprofit dental clinics who see substantial numbers of public program patients. Unallotments in 2009 reduced the critical access dental provider program by $6 million or more, and those reductions are already having a devastating effect on access to dental care for the underserved throughout the state. The criteria for dental clinic eligibility proposed in the supplemental budget would eliminate all private practice dental offices from the critical access dental program. And this would be especially devastating in greater Minnesota, where there are extremely few nonprofit clinics to see public program patients. If $3 million needs to be cut, and I sincerely hope that it does not from this program, but if it does, there are other approaches to address eligibility criteria that would not be so devastating to dental access in greater Minnesota. Alternative approaches to adjusting the eligibility criteria are being developed by a broad-based group of dental stakeholders right now, and an alternative proposal should be ready for you soon. I strongly encourage you to reject outright the critical access dental proposal in the supplemental budget and support dental access in greater Minnesota and the entire state through all dental providers. The supplemental budget eliminates the highly successful donated dental services, or DDS, program. The DDS program is supported with a grant from the Minnesota Department of Health and costs $63,000 a year out of the Health Care Access Fund. The DDS program matches dentists who volunteer free care with patients who meet certain eligibility criteria and dental labs who donate services for the dentists who are caring for those eligible patients. Patients who receive care through the DDS program are the elderly and disabled who do not have the financial ability to pay for the dental care they need. These are usually large case, complex case, comprehensive cases that are taken care of through the Donated Dental Services program. The $63,000 appropriation to the Department of Health in the current fiscal year will leverage $850,000 in donated dental care to approximately 230 aged and disabled patients. Approximately 400 dentists are active volunteers in this program. This payback ratio is extremely cost effective. I strongly encourage you to maintain the $63,000 per year appropriation out of the Health Care Access Fund for the Donated Dental Services program. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'd be pleased to
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for coming. Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Belzer, to be followed by the group of occupational and rehabilitation counselors.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Art Gonzalez. I'm the Chief Executive Officer from Hennepin County Medical Center. And with me I have Dr. Belzer, who's our Chief Medical Officer, and he's going to be available to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the Governor's proposed supplemental budget. We recognize, like everyone else who's spoken before you this morning, the dilemma that the state faces with respect to the projected shortfall. And nonetheless, we have grave concerns about the course being taken that disproportionately impacts health and human services investment in our populations and the institutions that serve them. You are familiar with HCMC for the role we play in trauma, burn center, emergency and disaster preparedness, and service to the uninsured and the underinsured. And we provide the largest volume of service to the uninsured in the Minnesota healthcare program recipients, nearly 20% of the state's total. We're also the third largest clinical site for postgraduate medical education in the state. More than half of the physicians in the state have done some or all of their training at HCMC, and two-thirds of our graduates remain in the state of Minnesota to practice, including the rural areas. HCMC's standing as a public hospital also enables the state to draw down an additional $72 million in federal funds and matching dollars that are currently distributed to other hospitals, community clinics, and other state services. HCMC has been on the primary journey of transformation to assure that we're an efficient and effective and contemporary healthcare system. legislative solutions that you passed in 2005 enabled us to change our governance structure and create flexibility to improve our performance, and we've been doing just that. Our cost increases have been at or below the healthcare inflation rate since that time, and we are not simply just a hospital. We're actively engaged in the state's efforts on healthcare reform and currently providing efficient services at the most appropriate sites of care, namely our clinic system, including 10 primary care sites that will see more than 375,000 visits this year. We have shown you documents to describe the role we play in serving the uninsured, and I know you have several charts before you, chart number one, and the underinsured, particularly in the GAMC program, which is chart number two. And we've already had to solve for $88 million worth of annual payment reductions when one considers that we are paid at 2002 costs less 15% and the overall health care inflation rate since that time, which is chart number three. We've already cut our operations to the bone. We've talked with you earlier about the crisis we face, and the current budget proposal moves us from crisis to catastrophe. We've tried to solve for the $50 million loss in annual GAMC payments and now have a hospital budget that's going to project a $25 million loss for 2010. And this includes the assumption that there will be a GAMC to MinCare rollover effective April 1st. The cuts contained in the governor's budget will result in another $19 million of additional payment reductions, and along with the 3% reduction in MA rates, delayed rebasing, MERC reductions, elimination of quarterly payments, and the loss of Minnesota Care eligibility for another 21,000 persons will increase our deficit and diminish our resource availability as a safety net provider and also through our clinics. Our commitment to medical education and our delivery system transformational efforts will also be affected. To be clear, the annualized payment reductions that HCMC will experience is $62 million. As many of you know, HCMC sent letters to surrounding metro counties to cite the uncompensated care that we're providing to the residents of those counties. Each and every county who responded stated that they believed it was a state issue rather than an obligation of local governments. The consequences of defunding and accelerated dismantling of the safety net are increases in mortality, higher total costs, even though the state costs will decrease, increased costs to local governments, social services, police, corrections, and health care, more people on the street in crisis, some of whom you've met today, including psychiatric, chemical dependency, homelessness, and unemployed persons. We're going to have to gate our system of clinics and the pharmacy at HCMC, limiting access to the uninsured who come from outside Hennepin County. More uninsured patients at HCMC. Our emergency department is the last resort option for the uninsured. Further program closures or downsizing, as we will be unable to carry programs with negative margins, and reduced resources for educating health professionals, and another layoff of about 150 to 200 individuals, as well as a reduction in our emergency disaster preparedness. All of this is coming at a time that is regressive to where the national health reform principles are going. Our ask of you is to recognize that the mechanisms that have been created to provide for the sustainability of safety net providers, that is, high-volume public programs who deal primarily with uncompensated care, that disproportionate share payments, the intergovernmental transfers, be directed to those purposes. Beyond that, if there is no temporary restoration to GAMC, there will likely be the need to create subsistence for other vital and efficient providers of care, primarily HCMC and Regents Hospital, to care for our citizens via uncompensated care pools, contingency funds to protect the solvency of the safety net, and through resolving metropolitan fiscal disparities. Health and Human Services and hospitals specifically have already given a great plenty to helping remedy our state budget. The course suggested by the governor's budget will mean further deterioration in health status, fewer health professionals, and more folks with severe illness seeking care in our emergency rooms. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Did Dr. Belzer want to testify also?
Dr. Gonzalez okay. did the work for us this morning.
Okay.
Madam All Chair,
right.
thank you.
Great. Well, Dr. Gonzalez, if I can just ask, does the $62 million include the losses of GAMC, or is that on top of the losses from GAMC?
That includes it, but we did account for the fact that there would be approximately a $7 million recovery from the move from GAMC to MinCare. There's also the additional supplemental budget reduction that is included in that $62 million number of $19 million.
So what are the additional budget recommendations what do they add up to in terms of an impact to you?
Well, the total impact that we have is that we estimated there would be a $50 million loss in GAMC payments, that the GAMC rollover to Minnesota Care would result in a positive number of $7 million. So that's a net of $43 million reduction. In the governor's proposed supplemental budget, he proposes another $19 million cut on top of that. So the 43 and the 19 adds to the $62 million that I quote.
Okay. Annually.
Annually.
Annually, okay. Are there other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Gonzalez, or Dr. Belzer. Is there any information about the patient, the person that's coming into your doors for uncompensated care? Do you track that as far as which ones are chronic, which ones are just for, you know, a simple, you know, head cold or something, or which one is extremely urgent? Do you have figures on that?
Yes, we do. And there is a substantial portion of the patients who I would classify, as you said, chronic people with chronic persistent illnesses, most notably the chronically and persistently mentally ill. But in addition to that, we also provide quite a large number of what I would call episodic care. Somebody who's well today and tomorrow is involved in an accident or has a sudden onset of something, we restore their health and they go back to their normal life. And we categorize that through inpatient, outpatient clinics or hospital, and we can provide you with data on that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Gonzalez, I understand that you do have an in-house clinic on site. Is that correct? That's separate from the emergency room?
Yes, we have not only clinics on site at the main campus, we also have clinics that are located out in the community.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen,
is there, and you know, no doubt that this population that has chronic issues because they're mentally ill or chemically dependent need some care, some consistent care. Yeah. Is there any way with those clinics or something that we can do to provide that in your in-house clinic instead of the emergency room?
Yes, we do.
Are you working on something like that to further? Because this is kind of the missing link, these, whether it's the open-door clinic in Mankato or some other safety net.
Yes, we strive to put the patient in the right venue of care that is most cost-efficient and best suited to their medical needs. And so we have not only acute care inpatient settings, we also have crisis settings, we also have the community clinic that we work with, and also other community agencies that we work with for referral and placement and disposition once they go beyond the acute care or even subacute care need of the hospital. So there's an entire continuum that exists for all of that. It's not simply if they come to the emergency room that we automatically put them in the hospital.
Dr. Gonzalez, do you triage people out of your emergency room into the clinic or other on-site settings?
Yes, sometimes they go into an observational status just to see, you know, how ill they are and is the problem going to resolve. Sometimes we avert them from the hospital altogether into a community clinic agency. Sometimes we put them in a short-term acute unit for treatment for of a day or two. Sometimes we refer them then into a continuing relationship into a clinic where they can have a we've been pioneering some work in medical home models, accountable care kind of organization things where we're able to treat them in a less acute setting.
Madam Chair, next to our emergency department, we have a lower intensity outpatient area called Express Care. And after triage, many of the patients with low intensity that do not need to be seen in an expensive emergency department are triaged just down the hall to Express Care.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To take this discussion further, Dr. Gonzalez or Belzer, what is your next step in that direction as far as reform? The dollars speak for themselves, but are you done with that type of thinking, or do you have plans? What are the discussions as far as?
We've been pioneering some work in that area now for a number of years. The problem is that there is no reimbursement mechanism to help fund that, and so we've been using internal funds to create these experiments for medical home type of program that we do in the case of the Department of Medicine, or trying to build the infrastructure for accountable care, including working with the county and some of the resources they have for making that possible. But to go the next step, we actually need a funding mechanism that will help perpetuate it and move it forward. If not, we're simply taking from one area of the hospital to another area of the hospital because it's the right thing to do, but it's resulting in additional deficits. The whole notion at the federal level would be to change the payment mechanisms and incentives to actually make that a self-funding, self-sustaining operation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Dr. Gonzalez, could you explain, if there were funds, what would happen exactly?
Well, it would depend on the kind of program that you would establish, but I'll speak generically. What would happen is there would be a defined population of patients that we would be assigned. There would be a certain dollar amount, some people would refer to it as a capitation, that says, here is the basket of services that we expect to be provided for this particular population. And it's usually risk adjusted according to their illness. Then we assume total responsibility of the care for that patient. So there's no incentive to do a procedure when it's not needed or put them in a hospital bed when it's not needed. You simply move them to the appropriate level of care, and you're compensated for that entire arrangement. Right now, what happens is that if you do something to a patient, you get paid. If you don't do something, you don't get paid. And so institutions with their high cost and technology and everything else like that, there's a general tendency to do things. And I'm speaking generically in healthcare. Minnesota has been much better about that than other parts of the country. Hence, I'll add one thing. Hence, Minnesota receives some of the lowest Medicare rates for being the most efficient. So the reward for being most efficient is reduced payment.
And Dr. Gonzalez, have you begun receiving any of the medical home payments that are in the pipeline? I am not myself entirely sure when they're supposed to start flowing to providers that are doing medical home.
I know. I'm going to defer to Mike Haristall, my associate.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I'm Mike Haristall. I work at Hennepin County Medical Center with Dr. Belzer and Dr. Gonzalez. Specifically, with respect to the primary care coordination program, that's the one enabled by the 2000 legislation, we do have patients now enrolled. The care coordination payment for those patients won't actually occur until 6 months have elapsed. So it's a future revenue. Specific to the healthcare home legislation in 2008 and the rollout of those plans, to date we've not had the opportunity to get any reimbursement for that. There's still some discussion and process before actually deciding how that money will be dispersed, the levels and so on. So at the moment we're doing that basically out of the resources that we have internally so far, but as yet no new revenue streams.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Gonzalez or Mr. Haristall or whomever would like to respond. You indicated that you have a high population of chronically ill people who show up on your doorsteps a lot. Are they eligible for some type of public medical care?
Under the current system that we had with GAMC and MinCare and so forth, yes, we would try to get them assigned into the appropriate program. Depending on their level of eligibility. So if SSI with the federal government was the most appropriate level, they would go there. If MinCare was more appropriate or GAMC was appropriate, then those are the payments that they would be assigned to.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
Dr. Gonzalez, then will you still be directing these patients into public programs?
To the extent that they qualify, yes.
If they exist.
Yes, I understand. I understand.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
I'm trying to figure out, Dr. Gonzalez, what your high rate of uncompensated care relates to, because in general there have been programs available for covering people.
Well, there are people who make slightly more than the levels that are required for this, and they fall into a different category. For what's going to happen and what we were talking about here is that people that were previously qualified for a program would now become uncompensated, and it would add to that level of proportion that we see.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan, you know it takes Right now, it's on average 2 months to get enrolled in Minnesota Care. So if you're presenting, that isn't going to help you until down the road. And there are people that have a 4-month waiting period after they lose insurance to get into Minnesota Care. There are maybe they have employer insurance offered to them, but it's at a 50% level, and they can't pay that premium. I mean, there are all kinds of gaps still in our system that, you know, sometimes we forget about in terms of the folks that are low income that don't qualify for our programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And that I had another point I wanted to make about something we were talking about earlier, but with regard to that comment, too, I know in Bemidji, the former hospital director there attributed the increase of uncompensated care in large part to the advent of the high-deductible HSA types of policies, because a lot of times people are buying those policies simply because that's all they can afford, or the employer is providing it because it's less expensive. The money to pay for health care is not put aside, you know. And so with more and more people going to those policies, they end up in the emergency room. They don't have the money to pay those initial dollars, and that's a large part of what he said was responsible for the problem. But I also would like to go back to Senator Rosen's point and just say that, you know, I know sometimes people think that people show up in the emergency room for care that isn't really an emergency, and I know that happens in some cases. But the hospital in Bemidji, for example, wanted to go to a 24/7 type of clinic, but because of the cuts to reimbursement rates and because of the difficulty getting doctors there, because their margins were already so thin, they just didn't have the money to develop that program. Now, if we cut these programs, like Minnesota Care goes bankrupt and GAMC isn't available anymore, Senator Rosen, we're just going to see that many more people ending up in hospitals rather than going to clinics where they should be going for a lower cost for those kinds of services.
Oh, I know.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen, very much. Karen Sames and others that have come to talk about therapy. And I'm just going to remind you that you have 2 to 3 minutes each. We do have to adjourn our meeting today at 10:45, and I am hoping to complete the agenda today because we were not planning more days for testimony.
Senator Berglund and members of the committee, my name is Karen Sames, and I'm a volunteer with the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. And in my paying job, I'm an associate professor of occupational science and occupational therapy at St. Catherine University. Occupational therapy enables people to do the day-to-day activities that are important to them despite impairments, activity limitations, participation restrictions, or the risk for these problems. Occupations are another name for these day-to-day activities. Occupational therapy helps people function in their daily lives related to home, school, community, and the workplace. MOTA urges you to reject the governor's proposed budget that calls for the elimination of rehabilitation services for non-pregnant adults enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs. You've probably heard many people call this proposal penny-wise and dollar foolish. I'm here to tell you that it's not penny-wise, it's penny-foolish. It would result in immediate increased cost to the state. It won't take long before people show up in emergency rooms because they've injured themselves trying to cook a meal, dress themselves, or bathe themselves without the adaptive equipment or assistive technology that occupational therapy provides. It won't take long for people with persistent mental illness to show up in emergency rooms because their ability to cope with life situations is diminished without the interventions provided by occupational therapy. It won't take long for people newly diagnosed with strokes, hip fractures, brain tumors, and such to be moved to long-term care facilities because they did not receive outpatient or home-based rehabilitation services and lack the tools and skills necessary to take care of themselves. Imagine two brothers driving home from a Twins game when their car gets hit by a drunk driver. One brother's 19, the other's 21. They weren't wearing seat belts and both sustained spinal cord injuries. Under the governor's proposal, both would receive inpatient care and therapies. But only the 19-year-old would receive outpatient therapy to continue to make progress towards self-sufficiency, have splints adjusted, and obtain assistive technologies to enable independence. The 21-year-old brother would not receive any outpatient therapy services. Every healthcare professional knows that quality rehabilitation services offer a great return on investment. Money spent helping people recover from disabling illnesses and injuries or preventing further disabilities saves future dollars in both acute and long-term care. The proposed elimination of rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, will cost more money than it saves. It's a very bad return on investment. A randomized clinical trial conducted in 2002 by researchers at the University of Southern California found that a 9-month course of once-a-month occupational therapy for older adults living in their own homes resulted in lower post-intervention health care costs. The 9-month OT program cost $548 per participant. The post-intervention, which was measured for 6 months, medical expenses for seniors who received the 9-month OT program was $967, far less than either the active control group, which was cost $1,726, or the passive control group, which cost in 6 months $3,334. Those in the experimental group, the ones that received occupational therapy, saved the state of California on average $2,400 per person in that 6-month period. Another randomized clinical trial conducted by Dutch researchers showed that the addition of occupational therapy to treatment as usual for people with major depression, and treatment as usual was outpatient psychiatric services, resulted in a reduced number of work loss days for those participants. When adults on Minnesota healthcare programs suffer disabling injuries or illnesses and are denied access to occupational therapy, they could lose their ability to work, to take care of themselves, and make themselves more financially dependent on the state. OT is cost-effective. MOTA urges you to retain rehabilitation services, including occupational therapy, for people on Minnesota healthcare programs as you negotiate the budget. We understand the economic difficulties that the state faces. We don't understand why, out of all the optional services available under Minnesota healthcare programs, rehab was singled out for elimination. We are actively working with representatives from the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association and the Minnesota Speech and Hearing Association to try to identify alternatives to eliminating rehab services to close the budget gap. We look forward to working with you to ensure that these services are available to the people who need them. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen Sames. If you could please get us as soon as possible what those ideas are, we'd appreciate it.
We certainly will.
Okay. Lindsay?
Yeah. As Karen said, Governor Pawlenty's proposal eliminates occupational, physical, and speech therapy for all non-pregnant adults on medical assistance, on Minnesota Care, and I'm here requesting that you do not include that language in your bill. My name is Lindsay Ginter. I'm an occupational therapist that works at Professional Rehabilitation Consultants. We provide occupational therapy to clients with serious and persistent mental illness. All of our treatments are ordered by a doctor. They must meet strict guidelines to prove that they're medically necessary, and ongoing care is continually reviewed. Referring doctors know how beneficial our services are in containing costs. Today, I have a copy of a letter prepared for you by Dr. Robert Baumer, MD, supporting occupational therapy treatment in the significant decrease in rehospitalization for his patients. What we do for our clients saves taxpayer money. The Department of Human Services reports that the average recipient of rehab therapy costs the state $3,240 per year, while the average psychotic episode requiring hospitalization costs $30,000. $486 at HCMC for the hospital bills alone. And as the doctor spoke to earlier, they're already overextended. And, you know, we can provide a lot of services that keep people out of the hospital. After these hospitalizations, the clients also often lose their homes. They require assistance to reestablish themselves into a home, to reestablish themselves back into the community. Occupational therapy treatment have proven over and over again to keep clients healthy, to keep them out of the hospital. The financial costs are obviously integral to why we're here today, but please also consider the toll that this takes on the clients when they undergo an event like this. I'm currently working with a client named Stacy. She's a single mom. In 2008 alone, she spent 45 days in the hospital, 27 days in a crisis bed stay. Now, I estimate the cost of this to be in excess of $150,000 for that year alone. Now, this was an extreme year for her, but extended hospitalizations were common for her. During that year, she was referred to our clinic, and with training and education, as well as more effective use of her resources, she's better able to manage her illness independently, and she's not been hospitalized since December of 2008. Stacy wrote the following: OT has taught me things that 7 years in psychotherapy hadn't brought out. There are a lot of therapy options available, but in OT, you work on goals for daily living, and the biggest difference is you leave feeling proud and hopeful. With my depression, I would never leave my house, but I make myself go because I learn a lot about myself. If OT were to be canceled, it would leave a void that no other mental health services offer. Now, Stacy's made a lot of progress, but she still struggles to manage her house independently, to set appropriate limits and boundaries for her daughter. She continues to need therapy if she's going to stay out of the hospital, if she's going to function in the community, and if she's going to be less dependent on the state both now and in the future. We work in conjunction with other treating professionals, providing people with the tools they need to be more productive members of society. On a weekly basis, we can provide for you testimonials in which we prevented serious situations from happening, which improves both the quality of life of our clients and decreases their mental and physical health costs. I'm confident that you'll be responsible in your bill, and please truly understand that these cuts, that eliminating rehab therapies, they will not save the state money. It will cost the state more money, both now and in the future. Because if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. But if you teach a man how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. I sincerely thank you for the opportunity to speak today and would welcome any opportunity in the future to speak on behalf of these vulnerable clients. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we take the next group on the panel, and then we'll take the questions for this.
Sure. And we did have a small change. Jenny will be speaking on behalf of Stacy, who was unable to come today, and Robert Wood, last minute, was unable to come. So we have two more presenters. So,
what about Greg Lavelle? Is he? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to once again come and speak before your panel, although it's unfortunate that it had to happen again. But I've been living in public housing for the last 5 years. During that time, I have worked hard at volunteering my time. I'm unable to work because of my mental illness. I've been dealing with mental illness since a mental breakdown in 1991. I'm a bipolar schizophrenic. Mental disorders are the leading cause of disability in the United States and Canada, and I'm one of that 1 in 17 people that suffers from severe mental illness. I made a difficult decision back in 1998-1999 to return to school to try to forward my skills and get back into the workforce. I started attending St. Mary's University of Minnesota a few years ago to get a Bachelor's of Science in Internet Security. I'm close to achieving that goal. I have 12 credits left to get, and I'm being funded by the Department of Rehabilitation Services. Hospital stays have been a problem with my attendance. Although most of that is behind me now, I have a new psychiatrist. He has me on a new regime of medication, and I have not had a hospital stay since July of 2008. Tomorrow I'm having surgery on my hip. I'm having my hip replaced. After that, I'll have several weeks of rehabilitating my right leg. I will be in need of things such as physical therapy and chiropractic help in order to achieve this. Then I'll be returning to the university to complete my degree and hopefully re-entering the job force in January of 2011. And I plan on going to the Susan G. Komen 3-day breast cancer walk in August and doing the walk with my replaced hips and a good pair of walking shoes. At times, it's overwhelming. Mental illness is an ongoing disease process without a single surefire cure-all for it. It is something that I have to learn to live with in my day-to-day life and will be a factor in for years to come. I need such things as occupational therapy. Since going to PRC, I have not had that return to back into the hospital. It has saved us money. It saved me time. They've taught me to be more responsible for myself. They teach me to cross-train some of my skills from other occupations that I've had towards my degree that I'm hoping to achieve by the end of this year. I need to talk therapy on a regular basis also in order to help these things to remain manageable. That's been my ace in the hole. Without it, I would have succumbed to my illness many years ago. Now I'm learning to live with it in order to become a more productive member of our society. Thank you once again for your time and opportunity to speak before you.
Greg, thank you for being willing to come and tell your story.
Thank you, Lady Chairman and Senators. My name is Jenny Beegler. I'm diagnosed with bipolar depression and receive occupational therapy services at PRC. OT has taken me from a scarred, intimidated, isolated, frightened person to a stronger, more sensible person. I used to be extremely vulnerable to bad decisions, including abusing drugs and getting in trouble with the law for writing bad checks. I was in an abusive relationship and manipulated by a man who took advantage of me. It was only through the help that I got at OT that I was able to break away from my relationship. Without OT, I do not know where my life would be today. OT has taught me that I don't have to be destructive or sabotage my life. I have learned to be strong and not to let people take advantage of me. OT has built up my confidence and self-worth. I can feel proud that I no longer dwell on my pain, and I work with my therapist to find healthy solutions to manage my illness and grow. Since OT, I have managed to stay out of the hospital and receive very little home services. OT keeps me from isolation and is a place for me to make safe friends. If OT was eliminated, I fear isolation and loneliness and the potential for me to return to drugs, need in-home services, and require inpatient hospitalization, which would increase dramatically. I just want to say that occupational therapy has increased the quality of my life 1,000% and still growing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being willing to tell your story also here today. Are there questions for any of the folks that have been on this panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Rick Mons and Judy Martyr, to be followed by James Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Mons, and I am speaking as a parent and guardian for our son, Alec. Alec is a 24-year-old man with Down syndrome. He lives at home, and the only publicly funded social services that he receives is through a nonprofit provider named Merrick. These services are paid through Ramsey County using Children's and Community Services Act funds, which are slated to be reduced. Merrick's services help Alec work in the private sector. He's currently working in a small mortgage company, digitizing documents. He enjoys his work and takes tremendous pride in being employed just like his parents, and employed like everyone else he knows. The governor's decision to cut CCSA funds causes a reduction in revenues to Ramsey County. As a result, Ramsey County has told us that Alec's services at Merrick will be reduced. He will be able to work only 3 days a week, or 3 weeks a month. he will likely not be able to retain his current job. The employer needs staffing 5 days a week and cannot grant 1 week off per month. Merrick has told us that Alec's limited availability will also make him a less attractive candidate for other jobs in the community. Moreover, Alec cannot be by himself for extended periods of time. Thus, his mother or I will reduce our income so that we can stay home with him. There is an ironic twist to this. When Alec turned 18, we could have asked that he be made a ward of the state. The cost to the state would have been much higher. In addition to Merrick services, the state would need to provide residential care and staff supervision when he's not at Merrick. Moreover, medical assistance would be his primary health insurer rather than our family group coverage. And here's the real twist. If Alec were not living at home, he would not receive any reduction of services at Merrick. Ramsey County's decision to reduce funding only affects the developmentally disabled who live at home. Those who live in group homes or other facilities receive day training services through other funding sources that have not been cut. Reducing these funds actually gives us a bizarre incentive to revoke guardianship. Alec would then have full services at Merrick. We'd then not lose income by taking time off from work. And we'd then reduce our costs for health insurance. But that would be at Alec's expense and, frankly, at the expense of our family. Minnesota has been a leader in deinstitutionalization and providing community-based services. This reduction reverses that direction. It is simply bad public policy. And in our family's case, it is perverse public policy. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Mons. Is Judy Martyr not here?
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm here today as in wearing two hats. I am a mom of a daughter with developmental disabilities, and I'm also a board member for my daughter's nonprofit service provider, Dakota Communities. I want to talk first about my role as a mom. Dakota Communities has served my daughter for 30 years, beginning when she was just 12 years old. Obviously, she's now 42. Her syndrome or label as an individual with developmental disabilities included the fact that she was not expected to live more than 20 years. As you can see, she's now 42, and I have Dakota Communities to thank for extending her life and giving her a full, healthy, happy life. And that's just so far. They have given her a home in a nice neighborhood with her own bedroom and her own sitting room. They have helped her do her own banking, helped her shop in neighborhood stores, and have helped her discover her own favorite restaurants. They have also given her a huge opportunity to give back to the community for all that she has received by helping her to volunteer for the Cancer Society and Meals on Wheels. All this for a tiny little woman who doesn't talk, walks a bit crooked because she has scoliosis, can't dress herself, and she needs 24-hour-a-day care. My daughter continues to expand her potential and capacity and zest for life thanks to Dakota Communities. Their mission to help individuals reach their potential and their very caring and well-trained direct care staff have indicated why she is so successful. Now I want to speak as a Dakota Communities board member. As a board member, we do know that the state's budget deficit calls for even more cuts to nonprofit service providers like us. We know that the state anticipates, we are realists. We know these cuts must come. They came to us last year. Up to now, Dakota Communities has been able to maintain direct care services to more than 230 individuals and their families, like me and my daughter, by being creative, innovative, and relying on quality staff to support the business decisions we have had to make. The big risk? Even more cuts may come in the next biennium. We cannot sustain these cuts indefinitely. As a Minnesotan for the past 40 years, a mom of a daughter with disabilities receiving services for 30 years, and a board member for over 20 years, I'm afraid of losing services at this point for my daughter. I am afraid that Dakota Communities will not be able to sustain its quality of care and services to Minnesota's family members with disabilities. I am afraid that homes like my daughter's will turn into many isolated institutions. This would be a huge travesty for Minnesota families. You all have tough decisions to make in the weeks ahead. I hope you will consider the importance of maintaining quality services for people with disabilities. Thank you.
Any questions of the committee? Thank you for your testimony. James Johnson and Scott Southwick, if you could come up to the table. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You could state your name for the record and go ahead and proceed forward with your testimony.
My name is James Johnson, Jr., from New Ulm, Minnesota. I am the substance abuse treatment coordinator for New Ulm Medical Center. This is a rural substance abuse program with 10 beds and residential and some outpatient services that collaborate with the Brown, Watonwan, and Blue Earth County drug courts. Scott's one of our graduates. He's not able to be here today. He is in school. He's one of our successes. He's in his fourth year in the university pursuing a career in drafting. And he's one of the recipients of consolidated CD treatment funds that one of our many successes. I also was going to bring a young man that I'm going to tell a story about a little bit later, but I want to thank the this committee and the senators for letting me speak to you today. I speak on behalf of addiction professionals, Southern Minnesota's drug courts, patients, recovering people, but perhaps most of the people that haven't been into treatment yet. I have provided some additional information to the page for your for you to look at, and some of my comments come from that document. First, the governor's budget proposal is in conflict with 8 years of the Bush administration's push to open the doors of treatment with increased funding. The Obama administration also contributed by breaking down access barriers and putting more dollars into the block grants. Minnesota counties or continues to be a state where access to treatment is amongst the worst in 50 states. Amongst the worst. We used to be the best. I understand that we're in tough times, but to move the $4.8 million surplus from the Consolidated CD Treatment Fund to the General Fund, given this information, seems absurd. I'd like to see discussions about opening up those dollars to the working class poor, or trying to expand access to treatment instead of making moves that would restrict its access, considering the savings of every $5 spent in treatment saves, or every dollar spent saves $5 to services throughout the state. Second, to impose a reduction in reimbursement rates to providers seems unfathomable. The results of such action will no doubt cripple some programs, resulting in job layoffs and program closures. 5 out of the last 10 years, the state has prohibited any rate increases and has frozen rates until July 2011. Over that same 10-year period, a cumulative increase has been a meager 17.5%, far below the increases in the cost of delivering these services. This all rides on the fact that there's a rate-setting process at the state right now for Consolidated CD Treatment Fund that seems in conflict with any reduction. I bring you one of many stories of the impact that reductions, restrictions, and decreasing access has on our citizens. A young man, 20 years old, that has been referred to treatment through the drug court with a threat of prison hanging over his head. He had a 5-year history of substance abuse. He works less than full time in a fast food establishment, lives with his mother in what could soon be a condemned trailer in rural Minnesota. And he doesn't qualify for public funding option for treatment because he makes too much money, under $9,000 a year. You are well aware the cost of incarceration in the Minnesota Department of Correction far exceeds the cost of long-term treatment, especially through the drug courts. And we have better outcomes. It's a sad story. I have many of those stories and would be willing to share those stories in writing or bring them to the committee. It validates the success of treatment and the failures of a system that used to be touted as the best in the country. I encourage you to find alternatives to the governor's proposals, perhaps a long-needed increase in the state's alcohol tax, a message you heard earlier this week, prepayment for treatment, a 10-cent per drink increase that would go a long way in solving a substance abuse treatment access issue. Again, I thank you for letting me talk to you today.
Mr. Johnson, another testifier on this issue of the treatment cuts suggested that we bring down those at the top by bringing down the average amount of reimbursement that is allowed rather than cutting everybody across the board. Would you find that to be a more acceptable solution?
I think that could be entered into discussion. What I didn't talk in detail about is the rate restructuring process that the state's already embarked in to go into effect in July of 2011.
We're aware of that.
But
we're aware of that. But, you know, our problem here is if we don't make budget cuts to help balance the budget out of this part of the budget, the governor can unallot. And so we're looking for better ideas, and I'm just running that one by you to see if you think it might be a better idea.
If you're talking about some cost equalization across the state in CD treatment, I think that is a good idea.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you for coming today. Jean Fahey, to be followed by Heather Molitor.
Madam Chairman, Senators, my name is Jean Fahey, and thank you very much for letting me this opportunity to speak to you of something that is very important to me, namely the care of the veterans in the Fergus Falls Veterans Home. I have been privileged to volunteer at the home since back in the beginning. I am there every weekday and weekends. I average 1,000 hours a year in volunteering. I know how they care for veterans, and very well, and at the top of the line. I can see their concern for each veteran. I also know that their challenges have been that they cannot get to the veterans quickly enough because there is a waiting list so long. Today, I think there's 90 on the active list, waiting list, and 250 on the inactive. This means that sometimes it takes 3 months to 6 months for a veteran and over a year for a spouse to be accepted. There are just important challenges that have to be made. On our new wing that is in construction right now is for an Alzheimer and a dementia residence. At the present time, we do not have the facilities to properly care for these people. Both of these needs were met by the legislature in 2008 when you voted $2.5 million to fund the state's match to the VA grant of constructing a home. I testified at these hearings with the hope that the Fergus Falls home would get the funding, and because of you, they did. Thank you. This last spring, we received word from the VA that our grant request has been moved up on the list for the VA due to the additional stimulus money and the desire to fund shovel-ready projects. We were fortunate that our administrator had the shovel-ready project to go, and we moved up from 66 to number 6. Since then, we have been off to the races. Groundbreaking took place July 29, 2009, and construction has been going on ever since. The project is scheduled for completion in December of 2010. But of course, none of this does any good if we can't put people, staff, inside the building to care for our veterans. The veterans' home does not have extra money to take this funding without additional funds. The $1.3 million that Governor Plenty has in this proposed budget will give us the additional dollars to assume that our veterans are properly taken care of. I urge the committee to follow through on the ends that this committee to fund the construction of the 21-bed special care unit in the Fergus Falls Veterans Home by also funding the cost for caring for these veterans with the new brick walls. With empty buildings, doesn't help the veterans. We would even be worse if to find not to be funded to the cost and caring for these veterans. What would be even worse would be not funds to care for these veterans with the new walls. And as I understand, the completion date of this will be in December of 2010, and there is no funding for the additional funds that we would need to operate at that point. So, Madam Chairman and Committee, I would like to thank you so much for the opportunity to speak about something that's very close to my heart, and I hope you will see that you will be in favor of this funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fahey, and thank you for your volunteer hours. We do appreciate it. Are there any questions? All right, then Heather Molitor, to be followed by Pat Santee.
Good morning, Senator Berglund, members of the committee. I come to you today as an employee of NHS North Star Specialized Services in Chisholm and also as a family member of a disabled child. At NHS, I work in a group home, direct care. There's four adult males living there, and they all require a lot of individual time and attention and a lot of help with their cares. Over the last 2 years, we've cut down from four staff on at a time in the house to only three, which as a result has come down to not as much one-on-one time spent with the residents in the house and also not as many community outings as we used to be able to do with them. It's important for their development and growth to be able to go out into the community and interact with their peers and do activities rather than just being, you know, sitting at home all the time and not getting out and interacting with people. Also, it's really hard to for the staff to be able to interact with them as much as we once could, because not only are we, you know, helping them with their cares, we're also responsible for housekeeping duties and stuff like that. So it's stretched out amongst three people what used to be four. And my worry is that if further cuts are made, then we'll have to cut down even more on staffing, and they won't be receiving the care that they all need and deserve and the social interaction out in the community that they once or that they even have now. It just results in less time that we're able to actually care for them the way that they need it. I'm also, as I mentioned, a family member of a disabled child. My sister Abby is 11 years old. She's received in-home services from NHS for the last almost 10 years, since 2001. So when she started, she was 3 years old. She's autistic, and she has a seizure disorder. When she started receiving services from NHS, she was unable to walk, talk, complete her personal cares, dress, or feed herself. And over the last 9.5 years, she's worked with the staff from NHS immensely through physical therapy and occupational therapy, and they've helped her to become more independent and to learn. And she goes to school full-time. She's in fifth grade. As of now, no cuts have been made to her program, and she receives adequate hours and services. But I fear that if further cuts are made, then she will not receive the amount of hours that she needs, and her developmental progress will start to decrease. I mean, she currently does live at home with my parents, but there's only so much that they can do, and they need the staffing hours as much as possible. So I'm here to ask you today to support no new cuts, because not only am I a family member of a disabled child, but I also work in the field, and I'm here today to give a voice to those who may not necessarily be able to speak for themselves. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Pat?
I live in Chisholm, NHS Horizons. I live with three other guys. I work for ODC. ODC, it's a shelter workshop up in Buell by Chisholm. My past, I had come a long way from where I live. I work 4 days a week with ODC. I did some bad. NHS has done an awesome job for me. I had stuff happen in the past, and I've been there living in the program for almost 14 years. I'm originally from northern Minnesota. And that's it.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for coming down to tell us your story today. We really appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Are there questions? Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, I want to also thank Pat for his testimony today. And I know some Santees. Are you related to the Santees up in that neighborhood? About Elaine? Do you know Elaine?
Yes,
Elaine?
Yeah,
Santee?
She's my cousin.
Yeah. Or very well. She's a great friend of mine. She works for the Department of Agriculture.
I've been with my parent family for 41 years.
Okay.
And I've known her quite a bit.
Okay.
Good stuff with her. I had an uncle that got bad. Something happened, and we're kind of close. I'm related to Arnold. Other people that are Santees.
We really appreciate you coming down here.
Yeah. Like I said, I came all the way from Chisholm to be here today.
We know.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Lights.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Lights, and I'm a Director of Child Health Policy at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. I want to start by saying that we are aware of the budgetary challenges that the state faces, but I do want to highlight for the committee how the administration's 2010 supplemental budget proposal will disproportionately impact Children's. The cuts proposed by the administration will have a direct and immediate impact on our ability to deliver the best quality of care to patients and their families. As the cuts accumulate, as they have over a number of years, they also have a longer-term impact as we are forced to make difficult decisions about where to cut back programs that are vital to health and the healing of children. Reimbursement rate cuts are cumulative. Delays in rebasing are cumulative. Reductions in supplemental DSH payments are also cumulative, and this presents with us lost opportunities over time. Let me take just a moment to highlight the impact of the governor's latest proposal on Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. As you know, Children's serves kids from every county in the state, and we also serve a highly diverse population. We translate in 43 languages, and we had over 50,000 interpreter encounters last year. We serve more children covered under medical assistance and PMAP than any provider in the state. Medical assistance is children's single largest revenue source, and it accounted for over 40% of our revenue in 2009. In comparison, an acute care hospital in Minnesota might average between 5 and 10%. For calendar year 2010, our supplemental disproportionate share payments are expected to total about $7 million. These payments were intended for providers who serve high percentages of Medicaid beneficiaries. This proposal eliminates that funding entirely. As a result of accumulated Medicaid reductions, Children's 2009 costs, not charges, in excess of Medicaid payments have increased to $43 million. Under the governor's proposal, Children's costs, again, not charges, are projected to exceed Medicaid payments by approximately $47 million in 2010. Overall, the governor's latest proposal will impact Children's by an estimated $26 million over the course of the next 3 years. This is in addition to the cuts that I've already discussed. Because of the role we play in serving Minnesota's low-income children, most of whom are on medical assistance, budget decisions related to medical assistance do disproportionately impact Children's to a greater degree than nearly any other hospital in the state. Whether we are talking about disproportionate share payments, rebasing, or reimbursement rates, the administration's proposal and the decisions made on each of these issues will hit children's hospitals and clinics disproportionately and very hard. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Are there any questions for him? I guess not. Thank you again very much. That concludes our testimony for today, and it concludes, I believe, our testimony on the governor's budget recommendations in general. We will not be meeting on Tuesday because that is the day the new budget forecast comes out, and so there will be meetings to get that information. We are not sure if the Finance Committee will be meeting Wednesday. Apparently they're meeting Wednesday, so we will not be meeting on Wednesday, but we will be planning to have a meeting on Thursday of next week. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Can you go up there instead of me?
Why would I kid about something like that?
That'll be kidding.
I gotta be around.
Yeah, I gotta be.
Hey, was there anything else?
Yeah.
I was hoping to make it up into the.
I know.
Right.
I don't need my face.
You don't?
We've been talking.
is up there.
No, what about the
let's see.
I understood.
Thanks, Ryan. I just wanted to say thanks for all your work on the testimony.
No,
we got through it.
Yeah, we got through it. So.
But you told me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have this one?
Yeah.
I don't have this.
That don't have this one over here.
I see you're like right in the middle.
You have a list of the senators.
The
senators that came today? Okay. So I'll go that. Let's see. Lynch wasn't present. You just need the ones that are present or everybody on the committee?
No. The general that were present right here.
Okay. Yep, she's the one that wasn't there.
Okay.
Everyone else is there.
Thank you, appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
I went to the Helen M. Plum Public Library, which sounds like something out of Clue.
It does.
Yeah.
Sounds very
I had an idyllic childhood. And having not so an idyllic